Meat for tea is the ticket, a buffet of the sublime, the valleys and beyond, avant-garde review, a cirque of word and visual art, film and music performance, served up by impresario Elizabeth McDuffie and Sone Labs sound guru Mark Allen Miller, putting a crisp five-star multimedia cool out there. And who, I ask you, wouldn't want a piece of that?
That's the record button. Have we started?
We have started.
So, this is the Meat for Tea cast. You might always start like that. Who knows?
Hi, everybody.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to the Meat for Tea cast, the podcast which is ranked number 3.
Yeah.
Out of the top 100 all-time performing arts indie podcasts and good pods, which is deeply, deeply disappointing because we used to be number 1.
You didn't see that coming, did you? No.
Well, there's your curveball. And we are grateful for the reviews you've been kind enough to leave on individual episodes. We love that. But the one that moves the needle...
There is a but.
The one that moves the needle is for the podcast overall.
Yeah.
And that's just at the very top of the podcast when you go into the Meat for Tea cast
on Good Pods.
It's at the very top of the podcast. You will see where you can subscribe to the show. There's a tip jar there. Mm-hmm. Let me know if it works.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Is anybody, I don't know if anybody's, for a while it looked like they, you know, we were having trouble when we were, JJ at Good Pods was an excellent, excellent helper in trying to get it sorted out, but we couldn't seem to get an account linked to the tip jar. I think we've got that sorted out, but I don't know if we've seen anything yet, so maybe somebody can test that for us.
Yeah, would you please let us know if it works? And also, if you really want to move the needle and see us back in our rightful position as number 1 in the top 100 indie performing arts all-time chart, give us a vote on the overall podcast. Be one of the people. There's only 9 people commenting there. Be number 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, up to 100. Be those guys. And move that needle.
Move the needle.
Move the needle.
All right. 2 minutes into the intro. Welcome to the Meat for Tea cast. I'm Mark Allen Miller.
You have your marching orders.
I'm Mark Allen Miller.
I'm Elizabeth McDuffie.
This is season 5, episode 12.
And it's a really good one. We have launched into the first of what will be several of my conversations with our Pushcart Award nominees.
Mm-hmm.
This one is with storyteller, short fiction writer, professor, an awesome person all around, Andrew Shelfo. We have a lovely conversation about his writing process and all manner of things, kind of veers off into writing
pedagogy for sure.
Pedagogy, yeah. A bit, because he discovered my bag is composition rhetoric, so you will hear some nerding out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, strap in for some nerding out. It's good, though. I just finished editing the conversation, I'll tell you,
nerding
folks.
Nerding out doesn't need any. It's good, though. Nerding out's always good and strongly encouraged on the Meat for Tea cast.
This is true.
No apology necessary.
Nerding out is actually kind of my life, anyway.
And if you're local to the 413, you should mark your calendars for this Thursday night, January 25th. I mean, Luthier's is the Unbuttoned Storytelling Night from 7 to 8:30. If you've got a story, sign up and tell it.
Yeah. We should do real quick housekeeping. We kind of already touched upon it a little bit in ways you can help us, but a couple other ways you can help
All
us.
All the very best ways you can help us are located on our website at meatfortea.com, M-E-A-T-F-O-R-T-E-A.com, where you can see how to subscribe to Meat for Tea. That's like the very best way, and you'll get Meat for Tea in your mailbox 4 times a year, which is awesome. You can buy individual print copies. We have a number of books, including a new one coming out really soon.
I think on the 26th, it's going to be available.
Called Fill Me With Birds by Scott Ferry and Daniel McGinn. Lovely collaboration.
Yeah, back and forth, conversational poems, basically. They had a conversation in poetry. It's really remarkable.
If you liked Midnight Glossolalia with Lil Nebokov and Lauren Sharhag and Scott Ferry, you will want to add this one to your collection as well.
Yeah, it's a good companion piece for sure. So also on the website, aside from the books and subscribing, you can also find links to our Patreon and to our spring store where we've got all sorts of things like t-shirts.
We're going to be launching a Groundhog Day sale in the spring store.
No, we'll probably be putting that up between this episode and the next episode. So if you go to our spring store, there's usually a banner at the top that runs our promotion, so you can just find the coupon code there. It'll be free shipping, basically. So
there's all kinds of things there. It's been very chilly where we are. And we do have hoodies, and we do have socks, and we do have mugs for your cozy cup of tea. We should have scarves. Do we have beanies?
I don't know.
We need those.
Yeah. It's been a while since I've been digging around in what products they offer that we can add.
Yeah, we need to add more things.
Last I knew, I was looking into adding summer stuff, and here we are in the middle of winter. Time goes by so fast, doesn't it, dear listeners? So, we do have a couple reviews.
We do. Thank you for reviewing on episodes, and please review on the whole podcast at large.
These are on the last episode, actually, season 5, episode 11 with John Yamaris, and I'll read one. It's from a regular contributor and one of the authors of one of our books, Jeffrey Feingold.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Yep, there's another one. Go buy that one.
Black Hole Pastrami and Other Stories. Yeah. It's winning all the literary acclaim. Yeah. It's winning so many awards.
Tons of awards. But Jeffrey, very lovely man, says, wonderful podcast. Host always asks insightful questions. Guests are invariably charming.
Yes, they are.
And we have
and
to say.
And he was.
We have to say, yes, indeed.
And this one is from Peter Erkowitz, who I should actually have come on as a guest.
Yeah.
He's the author of one of our earlier books, one that you should add to your collection. It's wonderful. Fake Zodiac Signs and Other Astrological.
Astroillogical? Something like that.
Yeah.
an astroillogical handbook, I think, is the subtitle.
It's hilarious.
It's great. It's marvelous.
And the illustrations are by him, and they're charming. He says, excellent conversation and great poetry.
Indeed. Indeed.
And if you didn't listen to season 5, episode 11, where John Yamaris talks to me about his book, People and Other Bad Ideas, and reads from it, and we get into discussions about all sorts of things, including krautrock.
Yes.
You will want to listen to that because it's a lovely conversation with a great poet.
Yes, yes, and very much is. This one, actually, in today's episode.
Oh, with Andrew Shelfo.
Yes, Andrew reads that story that he wrote that we published
We have his stories. That one was published in Russian Caravan.
But that was his first time reading at Meat for Tea Cirque, and he reprises a reading of it for us on this episode, and it's marvelous. About raisins. I'm not going to say any more than that.
No spoilers.
You have to check it out. So,
we should let you tuck into it.
I think without further ado.
And when you're done, you know what to do. But don't just leave a review on the episode. Leave it on the overall podcast. There's only 9 people who have done so. So you'll be noted.
Yes. And thanked. And probably read aloud on this year Meat for Tea cast.
Unless you want to take the initiative of recording a voice memo and sending it to us, and we will play your voice on the podcast because we love having your voices.
That is fun. And I will do that. I will, I promise. All right. Let's tuck into this really great conversation with Elizabeth and Andrew.
Hello, Andrew.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm very excited to talk to you tonight.
Me too. So let me officially invite you on and announce you. I'm thrilled to announce Andrew Shelfo, one of our Pushcart Award nominees for 2023, onto the Meat for TeaCast. Andrew Shelfo has had, and correct me if I'm wrong, two stories published in Meat for Tea, or do you go back farther with us?
Three. The first one was in the Russian Caravan issue.
Oh, that's, I should have dug in a little bit deeper. Thank you. And then, so Russian Caravan, Casserole. Russian Caravan,
Casserole, and then the latest one, I think it's the latest one, Chateaubriand.
That is the latest one.
Yeah. I was very excited to find Meat for Tea just literally around the corner from my house. Knowing that I live in East Hampton and Meat for Tea is all over East Hampton too. I love that idea. I love the fact that such a thing, Meat for Tea, exists near where I live. I love the fact that I can devour the issues when they come out. And then when I had the opportunity to be in it, that was a thrill. And going to the Cirque for Russian Caravan was awesome.
That's right.
Yeah. And then I haven't been able to get to the other two Cirques, but you know, there's always the next one, right?
There is. Let's hope that's always the case. The home of the Cirques has lately been the Divine Theater at Gateway City.
Yeah.
As I think you know, right?
Yeah.
And you probably know also that the future of being able to use Divine Theater as a venue might be finite.
Yes. It's undergoing more change, and not change in a good way at this point. Yeah.
It's sad.
It is. It's a great spot.
Beautiful venue.
The work that they did.
Oh my God.
Has been amazing. And the shows that they put on are great.
Right.
I was very sad to hear that they were facing difficulties again.
Me too. They're truly lovely people. I'm fortunate that I can do the March 9th Cirque there. That's when the next one will be.
That's for the next, that's the next one for the issue that,
the boba issue.
Boba, yes. I was inspired by that, and I've been working on a piece for boba. So I know I have a month to meet the deadline, so I'm working on that.
Oh, I'm excited. I can't wait. And that will be our 18th anniversary issue.
Oh, that's great.
It's a long time. It's time for Meat for Tea to pay some more bills. It's grown up now. It needs
that's
to
true.
Earn
it's
some money.
18. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's stuff it can do now.
Yeah, it should really do that. It should be in a different tax bracket than the one it's in. I've let it know.
Oh, good. That's the important part.
Yes, I've told it. It's time for you to earn more money, Meat for Tea. Get on it.
Yeah, you got to set the expectations.
Exactly. I'm glad you're inspired by boba.
Well, I find the themes, they're interesting. I find them thought-provoking. And I do, in addition to writing fiction, I do a lot of personal narrative storytelling. And when I do those types of shows, the shows are often centered around a theme, you know, much the way that Meat for Tea is. And what I learned doing those shows is, if you're doing a story slam where you're kind of competing against other storytellers, you have to really spend some time thinking about how you're going to approach the theme, because you don't want to be approaching the theme the same way that everybody else is. So I think that provided me some good training for how to approach some of the themes that you come up with.
Oh, nice. Yeah. And just, where do you do this storytelling? I think you did something at Unbuttoned, right?
Yes, I have my, I do a monthly show here in East Hampton at Luthier's Co-op. And that's a monthly open mic on Thursdays. And
yeah, I want to get to that.
Well, come on down. We're going to be doing it on the 25th. We're going to be doing it on the 25th this month of January. We do it on the fourth Thursday. Yeah, fourth Thursday of every month we do it. And that has turned into a great, small but dedicated group of people who get together once a month. And I see that show as a, what's the word? It's a show slash workshop. It's an opportunity for people who've never told a story on stage before to get up on stage and tell a story. And if they want some feedback, I'm happy to provide them, with the feedback. So that's a monthly show that I do. And then in addition to that, I've participated in the Valley Voices shows that happen annually that the Academy of Music and NEPM put on. And I've also gone to Boston and participated in some moths. And there are other shows
how cool. around
that I participated in. And I'm getting ready to do one in March out near Boston. It's called Suitcase Stories. And it is a long-running storytelling show that's based around the idea of, not the idea, based around immigration. So I was asked
by the
organizer. Yeah. And it's really interesting because, you know, I'm a middle-aged white guy, but I was talking to the organizer of the show and she said, well, you know, we all know unless we're natives, everybody has an immigrant story and everybody's immigrant stories are interesting to tell and interesting to listen to. So I'm working on that right now as well.
Oh, that's so interesting. Please feel free to send me all the links for that and for everything that you just mentioned.
No, that'd be
mentioned.
Great. Awesome. Yeah,
we'll, that would be awesome. We'll put it all in the show notes.
Perfect.
Yeah, because that's great stuff. So immigrant stories, like, would you be telling about your ancestors or your own personal immigrant story?
The story that I'm focused on, I want to make it a tease. I don't want to make it a spoiler. But it has to do with an experience that I had here in the Pioneer Valley about 15 or so years ago, where I was involved in it's kind of quaint to think about it right now because the internet was so much different in, you know, 2006 than it is.
True that.
Yeah, you know, so it was like a blog war that I was having.
Oh, sure.
Yep. And in the course of the blog war, the person that I was feuding with said something along the lines of, well, obviously he is in on it because he has to be in the mafia because his last name ends in a vowel. And
oh,
I was
my
like,
God, that's yeah, a gross overgeneralization.
Yeah, and I was like, I was like, really? Like that's where we are. And as I was thinking about it, I was reflecting back on some of the things that my grandfather told me. My grandfather was born in New Orleans in an Italian family, and when he was born, New Orleans, they were doing lots of lynching, and they were lynching lots of Italians. And then grandfather's family then moved up to Chicago. And my grandfather told me the story about how when he was a young man, he and a friend of his, they saw a KKK rally happening in a cornfield, and they
oh my god,
and they lit the cornfield on fire and chased out all the KKK people, And I remember, and I was like, I was so confused. I was like, well, why? Like, you know, Grandpa, you're white. Why was the KKK against you? And he said, well, it's because I'm Italian and I'm Catholic. Like, and I remember at that moment, I was probably, you know, 10 or 11. And I remember thinking, boy, there are people out there who are just really determined to hate other people. And they're just going to find any reason they can to do that.
Right.
But those are kind of the major themes that I'm working on.
I love that.
Well, thank you. I hope I can pull it off. And
that's so intriguing.
Yeah, it'll be a good show.
No, I want to go to Suitcase Stories now. I wonder if they would count when I moved to. I did my undergraduate degree in North Dakota, and I moved there from San Diego, California. And I didn't choose to move there or to do my degree there. It was a whole series of complicated events that led to me moving to North Dakota. And I suffered such severe culture shock because it was 1988.
Okay.
Having been, prior to the move, very active in the whole SoCal punk rock scene. I'm very active. Dated the roadie for Battalion of Saints. I had a pink floppy hawk. I was at all the hardcore shows. Attended Anarchy Picnic regularly. So apparently, when a person in 1998 with a pink floppy hawk and skull buckle boots and two kids in tow touches down in small town North Dakota, the residents find that something to point and stare at.
Wow.
They'd not seen the like before. Anyway, that's just in a nutshell. That's the immigrant experience.
Yeah, it does. You know, that does sound definitely like an immigrant, right? You were coming from one place to another, and they weren't ready for you.
It was wild. It was wild. People would go around the block, staring out their car windows and pointing. It was very weird because the way I looked in San Diego was normal for the scene I was in.
Yeah.
But there was no such thing as any kind of a punk rock scene in Dickinson, North Dakota.
And how many people lived in Dickinson, North Dakota?
Oh, God. I could only hazard it a guess. Maybe 10,000.
Okay. So that's pretty small.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not really Miss Census Population Master. My dad weirdly can tell you the population of almost any city anywhere. Just,
oh, wow.
And he's like a weird almanac human. I, on the other hand, are not. But, you know, a large contrast to the population of San Diego, California.
Right. Yeah. Very different.
Very, very different. They would brag about being 20 years behind the times.
Oh, they brag about that.
Brag.
Wow.
And record stores, when I'd ask for bands that I wanted to find albums by, like Butthole Surfers, I'd just get very odd looks and questions. Cool. Like, are you sure there is a band by that name? I'm like, yeah, I'm sure. I saw them play last year. There is definitely a band called Butthole Surfers. Look again. So, yeah.
We live in a large country, and there's lots of parts of it that are different than other parts.
Yeah. The amusing thing about New England, Massachusetts especially, is you can actually drive 40 miles and experience a different culture.
Right. Yes, that's true.
It's wild. Like, go from, oh, I don't know, downtown East Hampton to Palmer.
Yes.
You're in a different world altogether.
I remember once I was on a business trip to Dodge City, Kansas, of all places.
Of all places, indeed. That's like Dickinson, North Dakota.
Exactly. And I went, there wasn't really a lot to do there. So I had a rental car. I took a drive through Dodge, out of Dodge City and into Kansas. And I remember thinking, as I was driving by these, you know, these farms and farmhouses, I was thinking about how different my experience of growing up in this country was from the people growing up in this country outside of Dodge City, Kansas. And that,
oh,
that,
yeah,
that just still sticks with me. It's kind of wild to think about.
It is. It's the kind of thought that could be a seed that might germinate a good piece of short fiction.
I hope so. It's been that seed has been rattling around in my brain for about 20 years now. I haven't quite figured out what to do with it.
That's a rattly seed indeed.
Yeah. Well, I'm chuckling because the when I was there, it's a very small town. There's a very small airport. And as soon as I got out of the plane, it smelled, the city smelled. The city stinks, right? I'm gonna be honest on the podcast, okay? The city stinks.
Oh, and I won't tell them.
Well, that's the thing. They know, right? So I was there, and I was doing what I was doing, and then it was like on the third day, where one of the locals that I was working with said, "Boy, it's really been stinky here the last 3 days." And I was like, "Finally, somebody said it." Like, 'cause I didn't want to be the one to say it, but it's because of a lot of the beef production that happens there. A piquant odor to the town. So yeah,
that's a polite way to put it. Piquant. That's nice of you. I could think of other terms, but sure, yeah. Piquant.
Yeah, we probably just. I hope we didn't just tank the tourist dollars for Dodge City, but Dickinson, North Dakota. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately named Dickinson.
And I also wonder, like, what stories are they telling about me in Dodge City and about Elizabeth and Dickinson, North Dakota, right? That could be happening.
Well, it's interesting, actually. If you go back through the Meat for TeaCast archives, you will find a conversation I had with David Solheim and Barbara Lamon. And David Solheim was my English professor at Dickinson State University all those years ago.
Wow.
And he submitted poems to Meat for Tea some 4 years ago, I guess, or 5 years ago. Okay. And imagine the awkwardness if I declined them.
so he knew that it was that you were the person behind Meat for Tea?
Yeah, he's remained friends with my father.
Oh, that's great. That's awesome. Yeah, that would be awkward, right? Yeah, what if he didn't like him?
Well, I guess he wouldn't have subsequently been a guest on the podcast.
Well, I suppose the advantage of that is at least you knew what he was like, so you kind of had some idea of what a podcast would be like. Because I was thinking, this is really the first time that you and I have met. And I was admiring you for taking a leap and saying, "Oh, well, let's have this person I've never met. Let's have an in-depth conversation on a podcast."
It all the time.
Yeah, and maybe this recording will end up in he's a lunatic bin. We're going to put that over there, right? I don't know.
We don't have one of those. We haven't needed one.
Well, I think.
Yeah.
How do I know you're not just saying that? And number two, it's just my hats off to you for doing it.
No, I mean, first of all, I know things about you because I have read your work.
That's true.
And I've met you at a Cirque. And I think you did read at the Russian Caravan Cirque, did you not? I did.
And it was a wonderful experience because
they're fun, aren't they?
They're fun. And it was the first thing I had published in a long time.
Oh, I'm so glad.
I read it, and the people there at the Cirque gave me such a wonderful reaction to my story that it was an awesome time.
This was at Abandoned Building Brewery.
Building. Yep.
Yeah.
ABB. Yeah.
Yeah.
That story was a story that came to me in a dream.
Ooh.
And that had never happened to me before, but I it was a situation where I woke up. And I had this story in my head, and I got on the computer very early one morning, and I typed it all up, and then I forgot about it, and then I went back to look for it, and I couldn't find it, and I was in one of these weird loops where I was saying to myself, "But wait a second, you had a dream about the story, and then you wrote it down. Did you have a dream about writing it down? Because I couldn't find it." And then what I discovered was, instead of like writing it down in a Google Doc or something like that, I had written it down in an email to myself. So I was just looking in the wrong place. And then I found the email to myself. But for a moment, it was like getting really, really creepy. Like, how did this happen? Is this all just an opium dream? Like, Coleridge had? I don't know. But
wow.
It was a only time that a story came to me in a dream, and then I lost it, and then I found it again, and then I was able to take it and finish it the way I wanted to. And as I said, the reaction I got reading it at the Cirque was great. So it was just a wonderful night.
Yes, I remember. You know, you've provided a really great segue to read that story if you were in a mood to do so.
That'd be great. I just so happened to have it in front of me.
Oh, well, I love how that worked out. Well, why don't you let us have it? I'm excited to hear it again.
Okay, this story is called Beware of Raisins. Marvin walked into work today and found something on his desk that made him reevaluate his relationship with the raisins. That something was a raisin. Sometimes at the end of the day, Marvin tidies his desk so that he can start the next day with as clean a slate as possible. Yesterday was one of those days. He certainly would have noticed before he went home a raisin just sitting there on his desk. You might be asking, rightly so, how did the raisin get there? You might think that was also Marvin's first question. It wasn't. You see, that's a logical question, and Marvin lives with two teenagers, so he's given up on any reliance upon logic, especially when it comes to why things are where they are. He's found all sorts of things in unlikely or even confusing places. Dishes in the bedsheets, food under the pillows, a shoe in the refrigerator. When he'd find something odd in the house, like, say, a muddy cleat on the dining room table, he'd ask, logically, how did this get here? One or the other of his sons would look at him like he was crazy, and then he'd get the pat answer, I don't know, with the facial expression subtext of, what are you asking me for? So while Marvin does blame his children when he finds things in the house where they don't belong, he doesn't think they're involved with the raisin. He doesn't think his sons are raisin evangelists working for a big raisin. Still, just to be safe, he texts his younger son and asks for his thoughts on raisins. At first, there's no response, and then there are the texting bubbles for a long time, so long that Marvin is convinced that his son is convinced that Marvin must be having a stroke. Marvin follows up with another text explaining that it just was on his mind. The son replies that he likes raisins, but doesn't actively seek them out by texting, meh. This stance makes sense to Marvin. In fact, it matches his own feelings about raisins. Neither the son nor his brother objects if Marvin brings home cookies that have raisins in them, a rare occurrence. But then they don't object if Marvin brings home raisin-less cookies either. More telling of their raisin preferences, perhaps, is the fact that their preferred cereals, cereal being their main source of sustenance, are not raisin-laced. And while he's occupied with the topics of logic and cereal, Marvin wonders why it is that teenage boys can wallow for days on end in their own filth, yet not be capable of grasping the simple concept of rinsing and reusing a cereal bowl. Mm-hmm. It's like they could only use sterilized bowls and utensils, which Marvin would be okay with if they do the sterilizing occasionally. After a weekend, it looks like he's fed an army. But that doesn't have anything to do with raisins, I suppose. Marvin finds a raisin on his desk and he can't ask, how did it get there? Instead, he asks himself, what are the raisins up to? Raisins are all around us, all the time, of course. But Marvin has never really felt threatened by them. It's not like raisins are kale or pumpkin spice or mango, you know, foods that kind of bully their way into our lives. If foods were countries, pumpkin spice would be kind of like Russia, something we could probably coexist with, but something we must be wary of as it annexes one food group after another. If raisins were a country, they'd be kind of like, well, Belgium. If someone said, hey, would you like to go to Belgium? Most people would probably say, sure. But if you asked them to make a list of 10 countries they'd like to visit, Belgium probably wouldn't make the cut. From everything I know, Belgium is a perfectly nice country, but it's a bit of an afterthought. Is this thing on Marvin's desk an afterthought? Marvin wonders if he's making too much out of this random discovery. He won't admit this, but he spent way too much time contemplating this dried fruit. He even began to wonder why it's called a raisin. He looked it up as part of his contemplation and discovered it's from an old French word for, you guessed it, grape. Somewhere in history, someone thought that calling a partially dried grape a grape would be too confusing, so they decided to use an old French term for grape to distinguish between the two. But that brings Marvin's mind to an existential question. When does a grape become dry enough to qualify as a raisin? He thinks about that, too, for far too long. Finally, he has his proof-Rockian moment. He realizes the only way he can get past this raisin conundrum is to eat the raisin. He picks it up and pops it into his mouth. That's when he's reminded of just how quickly the human mind can work. In the moment between the raisin leaving his hand but not yet entering his mouth, a series of new questions pops into his head. First, what if this isn't a raisin? What if it's something that only looks like a raisin? Second, what's a common thing that only looks like a raisin that I might find has mysteriously appeared on my desk overnight? Third, did I just toss a piece of shit in my mouth? We often say of our enemies that we want them to eat shit and die. However, we also say that someone has a shit-eating grin on their face, which is a sign of self-satisfaction. In the Ultimate Guys movie, Shawshank Redemption, the main guy swims through a river of shit and comes out clean on the other side. This was Marvin's last thought before the raisiny item hit his mouth. And that's the lesson for Marvin. There are no guarantees in life. No matter how tidy you leave things, something can come along and mess things up. And sometimes, to clean things up again, another way of saying find out the truth, you must risk possibly eating some shit.
Can you hear the snapping?
Was that you snapping? That was good. Well, thank you. It was just as much fun reading that this time as it was reading it at the Cirque.
It is so wonderful. And that came to you in a dream?
It came to me in a dream. Yeah. That's, I mean, there's stuff around the edges that I filled in a little bit.
Of course.
About, you know, the suns and stuff like that. But the arc of the story was just kind of came to me fully formed in a dream. It's the only time this ever happened to me.
And so great.
I'm waiting for it to happen again, I think. I don't know. Do I want it to happen again? I guess.
Yeah, I think you do.
Yeah, it was. I referenced Coleridge before, and he mm-hmm. famously had his poem interrupted by someone who stopped by, you know, the man from Warlock.
And right.
It was like, you know, that had me thinking about that because he woke up from a dream and started writing things down. I don't want to do the opium. So I just want to be clear.
I was going to say, his dreams were helped along.
They were helped along a lot.
Considerably. Yeah, and the story makes me think of so many things. One was when my youngest daughter was just one, maybe a little bit younger, even in her high chair. She would request poop, 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 very emphatically banging on her high chair tray. And that happened one time. I shouldn't say would request, she did. And I searched all around the kitchen and I found one thing after another edible that might look like what she was asking for. And finally, I found a box of raisins and put that on her tray and she sighed. She's like, ah, poop. It was so funny. She's just one. I don't know. It looked like it to her.
Well, I mean, yeah, you know, that I get that. That's what Marvin went through too.
It was an astute observation, I think.
She was very astute back then. I'm sure she's still.
She's 30 now. But then there's also Alton Brown, who famously said, "There is no food that has ever been improved by the addition of raisins."
Oh, you see, I wish I'd known that. I could have used that in the story.
Yeah.
But do you agree with me that most people are, I don't know, I shouldn't say most people. I don't think I've any met anybody who's a raisin enthusiast.
I can't say that I have. I'm actually not sure that I even want to.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I agree with Alton Brown. Then there's also Anthony Bourdain's wonderful quote about pumpkin spice, of which he famously said that he wished it would drown in a pool of its own blood.
I like that one too.
Isn't that good?
Yeah, that's a good one too, yeah. Do you have one for kale?
Not yet. Okay. I have a large collection of cookbooks and food writing, so I might be able to dig one up.
All right. Well, we'll have to. I got to keep my eye out for one of those too.
No, one year actually for Halloween, I just dressed up as the most terrifying thing I could think of, and That was, of course, pumpkin spice.
I'll be honest and say I don't get that. I don't get the pumpkin spice thing. But
I think it's dumb. I think it's just dumb.
Yeah.
Sorry, all you pumpkin spice enthusiasts who immediately stopped listening to the Meat for Tea cast.
And just think what the pumpkin spice people in North Dakota and Kansas are doing now. They're really mad at us.
They're furious. They're boycotting it. They're out in the streets with a Meat for Tea cast signs protesting. Actually, I wish they were.
Yeah, that would be, no such thing as bad publicity, right?
Right? That would work for me. But dreaming and writing are brought together really wonderful by a local author. And she was at, I invited her to feature it Unbuttoned during the brief period that I was running that show for Allison. Sivia Gover.
I don't think I've seen her there, but I'll have to check her out.
Yeah. Well, she's got a really cool book called Dreaming on the Page.
Dreaming on the Page. I love that idea.
Yeah. She has workshops too. Zoom Dreaming on the Page circles. I attend those.
Oh, wow.
Regularly.
Where is she located?
She's local.
Oh, great.
She's right here. Does she live in Hadley? I want to say Hadley. I'm not sure. She's local. She's not far from here. Actually, Splendor Soulless Booksellers is having her as their Arts Night Out reader, I think the first Friday in February.
Oh, that's awesome.
But these workshops are so cool. It's helpful if you can remember your dreams and have some written down. But she's got workarounds if you don't. And she has you take dream dictation and has a number of varying prompts that help you take that dream fodder and turn it into publishable writing.
Do you find that doing that makes it easier for you to remember your dreams?
I don't usually have a hard time remembering them. I have a hard time writing them down because when I wake up from REM sleep, I'm so groggy.
Yeah.
That like my hands don't work. Mm. Like I'm so groggy. And she advises keeping a notebook and pencil next to your bed, but that wouldn't work for me. Because that's a whole lot of dexterity that would be asked of me. So I found that my smartphone, and this is the only time in my life I've ever appreciated autofill, the notes app, and I can write down the words of what I saw in my dream, and you know the suggestions that come up, I can just, if that's the right word, I can just click that, and in my groggy state, I can get a dream jotted down there.
Oh, that's great. That's a good idea.
It's the only way I can do it because, yeah. You know, sometimes when you wake up from a dream, I mean, biology is what it is. I think most of us wake up from a dream because we need to pee.
Mm.
Invariably, if you're awoken from sleep, especially if it's before you wanted to get up, like if it's 4 a.m. or 5 a.m, just earlier than you wanted to be up, it's probably just because you had to pee, which right. is why the last part of, I think, a lot of people's dreams is seeking for a bathroom.
That makes sense.
Well, yeah, it does. I could just write a little short poem series about bathroom dreams and the unspeakable places that would appear in my dreams. It's like, you could try to go here, but you're not going to find an acceptable one. Maybe I should. But yeah, I strongly recommend Dreaming on the Page. I don't know. I had a piece published in Silkworm.
From the Dreaming on the Page workshops?
Yeah. In Silkworm 16. So it works. You get good pieces out of it.
Yeah, and it sounds like a great method to be able to do it more reliably than what I do, which is wait for lightning to strike again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's the same idea as like, if you're going to be, you obviously don't wait for inspiration to strike before you write at all.
True.
Right. So right. I think it's the same thing. It's just that incorporating that dailiness, although this would be more like nightliness. I guess. Yeah. Just getting that regularity, because it's all really just perspiration, not inspiration, right?
Sure. Yeah, and I think it's also looking at different things for inspiration or perspiration, right? It's not one thing for everybody. That's not going to work for the same way for everybody. So getting your inspiration from a dream, that's great. You get your inspiration from looking out a window, that's great. As long as it's providing you with a result that is meaningful, that's really what matters.
Totally. Yeah. What's your writing practice? Do you have a regular kind of writing schedule?
I try to write every day. I'm usually successful at doing that. I have found that over the past, I want to say 6 months to a year, my writing has been going through a bit of a shift. And by that, I mean, I've been doing personal narrative storytelling for a little over 10 years now. And during the pandemic, that was actually a good time for personal narrative storytelling, because there were virtual shows happening all over the place. So there was lots of opportunity to tell stories and be in shows. And at the same time, I got connected with some really wonderful storytellers, and we would workshop twice a week on stories. And that was like I compare that to a postdoc degree.
Oh, wow.
Right. Like that's how intense it was. And that's how good these people were and are at doing it. Cause we still meet. We meet once a week now when we do it.
How wonderful.
It's great. I mean, it made me appreciate not just, well, it made me appreciate what a story is. It made me appreciate the challenges involved in telling a good story, whether it's actually physically telling it or physically writing it, depending on how you do it. But it also made me understand on a deeper level the value of providing actionable and honest and intelligent feedback to somebody, because that's something that is not easy for some people to do. So mm-hmm. I learned all those skills. So then when the pandemic ended, I felt like my brain was empty. And by that, I mean, personal narrative storytelling is great. And the hallmark of it is that you're telling true stories. You're telling stories about things that happened to you. And that's great. And I want to adhere to the rules and all that stuff. But it can be, I found it exhausting to have to kind of think like, okay, well, the theme is, you know, let's say the theme is new beginnings, right? Like, okay, there's a show in Boston and the theme is going to be new beginnings. Then I have to sit there and I have to think, okay, well, what's something that's happened to me that I haven't told before that would fit with the theme? And it became, it made my head hurt a little bit. And then mm-hmm. I realized like, wait a second, you know, I don't have to always write true stories. I can write fiction, right? That's where fiction comes in. So I've been making this shift to writing more fiction, and it's more fiction, and it's also more fictionalized accounts of what are mostly true stories, I guess I would say. I was listening to the Meet for Tea cast that you did with Jeffrey Feingold, and I know you had a lot of discussions about, you know, truth in story and fiction in story and all
that. Yeah. And I'm glad you picked that one.
I am too. When we talk about narrative storytelling, we talk about emotional truth, right? Like the details don't really matter as much as long as the emotional truth is there. And I'm one of six kids, and I have the experience all the time where I'll be with my siblings and I'll talk about this thing that happened 1 year at Thanksgiving. And one of my siblings will say, that didn't happen that way. And it doesn't matter who's right, because both of our experiences are equally valid and equally valuable. Mm-hmm. But the idea of truth and how all these things work out, it's not as important. I mean, it is important. I don't mean to be dismissive of it. It shouldn't be a barrier to telling a good story is what I'm saying. So I've been experimenting a lot with going, I'll call it going both ways, taking a story that I would tell on stage and then turning that into a written piece, and then taking that written piece of a true story and turning it into a fictionalized piece. So I've been working a lot on fiction and flash fiction pieces and things like that. And I've been talking for so long, I forget what your original question was. Oh, yeah. What's my process? So, yeah. You know, I'll get up in the morning and I like to write early in the morning for a while before I have to go into work. And then if I have time later on in the day, if I get back to it, that's where reviewing and editing will happen. But I find that I'm most open to new ideas early in the morning.
Mm. Wow. I try to write every day too, but I'm not one to get up early to do it. I early morning is, well, I have a lot of allergies and mm-hmm. I take Benadryl every night.
Oh, okay.
So it makes for a very groggy early morning.
Yeah, I get that. I get that.
Yeah.
I will get up, I'll have my coffee, I'll write. And then when I'm done writing, most days a week, I'll then go out for a run.
Nice.
Because, you know, I guess because I like to do challenging things, like writing is hard, running is hard, but they're challenging and rewarding. So, and I think if I do them in the morning, I feel like I've gotten them out of the way. I've gotten the hardest thing out of the way already, and then the rest of the day is going to be easy.
Yeah. No, I write first. It is the first thing I do, but it's not early, not by most people's definition. And then after that is Qigong. And I have the same thing. Like, I actually won't have breakfast or brunch until after I've worked out. And that's the hard and fast rule, is the Qigong has to happen first. And writing has to happen before everything.
That you're preaching to the choir.
Yeah, I think just do that stuff first. Then you did it.
Yeah, you have it out of the way, right? And then the rest of the day should be easy.
And some days, to be honest, like I like to write a couple of pages a day, but some days schedule and other things might dictate that it's a paragraph, but. Just showing up, and someone else said this, and I wish I remember who they were, showing up on the page every day, just show up on the page.
Yeah, I like that idea. I've never thought about it like that before, but I like that, yeah.
I think it might have been Annie Lamott.
Okay. Some days, that's all it is just writing down a sentence, but at least we've done it, right?
Exactly. Yeah, even a to-do list. Although I hope we get more done than a to-do list, but even that.
Yes, we got to get more done than a to-do list.
Yeah, I think that's, no, I like that. I like that a lot. Do ideas come to you when you go for a run? Do you process writing while you're running?
It depends on what I'm doing that day for a run. I like to listen to podcasts on a lot of runs.
Yay.
But
happy to provide.
Yeah, you do. You get the long podcast too. But if I'm doing a workout that I have to go faster, then I'll listen to music. So I think I guess the answer is no. I don't really work out writing problems when I'm running because I'm concentrating on something else.
Sure.
And we'll be back in just a moment.
Death by DVD. when watching is never enough.
Hi, I'm Harry Scott Sullivan. You may know me from such podcasts as, Death by DVD. We here at Death by DVD sit painfully through hours and hours of movies, so you, the public, can make an informed decision of what you put in your ear holes and eye holes. Some of these films are good, some bad, and some even unmentionable. But all have one thing in common. Watching all of these movies will one day melt our brains into a sloppy wet mush. No need to thank us. We were already methodically destroying ourselves with cinema. At least this way, there is a permanent record of our demise. As the midnight hour approaches, the smoke sets heavy and the booze begins to flow like blood. Tune in and drop through hell with your host, Harry Scott Sullivan. That's me! Featuring horror artist I. Alexander Nash and more as we take you on a journey through the worlds of horror, gore, cult, strange, slasher, psychotronic, trash, twisted, gornography, weird, driving, cheesy, lost, rare, and frightening films. Join us and listen as life collapses upon itself.
Every episode of Death by DVD is available to stream and download directly at www.deathbydvd.com or wherever you find podcasts. Apple, Spotify, Good Pods. Just search for Death by DVD.
I'm Linnea, and I like Death by DVD. It's a statement.
And welcome back.
So you asked me if I worked on any writing things while I was running, and I still don't think I do. Now that I've had time to think about it a little bit more, But what about? I'm curious what you say about that. Like, what are there any other activities that you do where
writing happens?
Yeah, where part of the reason you're doing it, it might be because, oh, I know if I do this thing, that's going to help me get through this part of this piece that I'm having trouble with.
Yeah. And no. So here's the thing, though. Especially in grad school, my house was never cleaner than when I had a paper due.
Yep.
You know, that elaborate grad school procrastination ritual that comes before the seminar paper.
Yep.
The pain.
I teach English to high school seniors.
Yeah.
And I talk to them about the writing process. And when I mentioned what you just said, like, okay, talk me through your steps in writing. And they don't really know how to answer the question because they think I'm trying to trick them or something like that. But then I say, okay, let me guess what your steps are. And I say, well, step number one is you're going to start cleaning your room. And they all kind of laugh because I don't know if they've ever really intellectualized that process. Like, oh yeah, I do that, but I've never really thought about why I do that. And I didn't know that everyone else in the class does it too. That could be a part of it. And then I also tell them, because a lot of the students that I teach, they're also very good athletes. And I said, you gotta treat writing like you would your number
one. It's a muscle.
Yeah. You wouldn't go out there and just be like, okay, it's game day, let's go, right? You've had weeks or days of practice and you've worked on certain things that are going to make you perform better. So why would you expect writing to be any different? And that meets with a mixed response. Of course, I think I'm right. I believe firmly that I'm right. I just wish I would see more students you know, putting in the they call it pre-writing work, right? Putting in the pre-write. Right. And unfortunately that's, I don't know how much of that is really happening in our schools today. Boy, that went on a downer note. I didn't really mean it to go down.
No, I don't mind. I don't know if you know, I was a English professor for
so was
a while.
I was too.
Where?
Seton Hall University in New Jersey.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. I was working on the doctorate, which I didn't finish. I am ABD.
ABD.
Mm. One of those shameful individuals.
So should I say now that I did do my dissertation, or should you have Mark edit that out?
No, congratulations, Dr. Shelfo.
I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. I did finish the dissertation, but I'm just having fun with you.
No, but still, that's really cool. I have wanted to. That you can, if you listen to other podcasts, you can hear about what happened to my PhD.
Oh, I love that. Now I'm going to go start digging through the archives.
Well, just in a nutshell, it takes a lot of hubris for a single mom of three kids with two left at home to think she has time to do the PhD. And when year two of the doctorate, child support stops coming in and you've got to pick up an extra section.
Yeah.
Yeah.
and of course what you're talking around is one of the great sins in higher education is the chattel that we turn our graduate students into so that they can, you know, teach
or
for
adjunct
at very poor rates of return. Yeah.
Or adjunct faculty too, who does the bulk of teaching anywhere and gets the least pay.
Gets the least pay and gets the least respect and does most of the work. Yeah.
Does a lot of it. But I taught at UMass while I was working on the doctorate, and then I got a gig at Holyoke Community College, which I deeply loved. I really loved it.
Yeah. And how do you find, when was the last time you were teaching? Are you still doing it?
No, that ended abruptly with a very evil dean.
The classic evil dean story. Yes. Everybody's got an evil dean. They're all around. Yeah.
It's an archetype.
Yeah, absolutely.
By now, it's like the Wicked Witch, the evil dean. I mean, there's got to be a Grimm's Brothers story. Das evil dean in the forest. Like,
yeah, but we could share those stories. We'll do that. We'll do that offline sometime. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can. I think I have shared it online. I just haven't named her name. The good news about the evil dean is I did sue and I did get her deposed and I did get some money, not as much as I wanted, but I got some money.
Wow, that's amazing.
Which went into buying a very beautiful new gas oven.
Wow.
And I think of her when I preheat my cast iron Lodge combo cooker before I bake my sourdough bread.
So it's kind of like...
I think of her.
It's like an inverse of a Wicked Witch story, right? Like the witches who would try
Hansel and Gretel.
Yeah, who would try to get the kids in the oven, but you, in a metaphorical sense, took the witch who was, you know, putting bad spells on you and put her into the oven.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. I like that idea.
It works. Bad deans. Why do we suffer the bad administrators? That is like a big problem, and they get a lot of money to suck at their jobs.
I'm just thinking we're adding to our list of people who are going to be furious at us now.
They probably weren't listening in the first place. So.
but when you were, let me ask you a question, because this is something that I think about a lot.
Uh-huh.
And I have a son now. My younger son wants to go into communications and journalism.
How old is he?
He wants to write. He is 21.
Oh, nice.
Writing for the Daily Collegian. He's at a game right now covering.
Oh, he's at UMass. Nice.
Yep. And I just, so I think about him and I think about my experience of becoming a writer, which of course for all of us takes a lot longer than it should, because we have this hang up about admitting out loud that we are writers, right? You know, like that just happens. And then I start throwing in there these, it's like I'm making something in your wonderful oven, right? And then I throw in a dash of AI and what is artificial intelligence going to do for writing in the future? And what is artificial intelligence doing now
to the capacities
of our students in high school and college in terms of how they are going to learn how to write? And the short answer is I get really scared.
Mm-hmm.
But a longer answer is that I've been really amazed over the last, 30 years or so of how important words are for our culture, our society, and specifically for the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And because in the beginning, like when there were first web pages.
In the beginning,
there were just pages that had words on them, right? And that was all that the website was. And then you got to pictures, and then it became about graphics and things like that. But still, the coding was all words, you know, it was all language. And then the stuff behind what you see on the website, that was all words. And you think about things like search engine optimization and all that other stuff. So now you think about artificial intelligence, which is based on large language models, which is analyzing our words. And I try to take away a certain amount of validation that my English major was not a waste, that really one of the most important things anybody can study is
words.
Is words. And mm-hmm. sure, there's artificial intelligence out there that currently creates not great prose that if you are adept at it, you can tell. That will probably get better, which is, I don't think it's a good thing.
No.
But I think it does, at least right now, it kind of highlights the skill set of people who can differentiate between good writing and bad writing.
Right.
At least I could be totally wrong, but that's my hope. That's what I try to get me sleep at night.
Yeah, I agree. So wow, you just opened up that can of worms. Well, here's one thing is I'm kind of glad I'm not teaching right now, because it seems like a really complicated time to be teaching college and having to distinguish between human written and AI written projects. And do you bring back the blue book? Do you have them right in front of you in class? So there's all those thorny issues that arise. I've read a little bit of AI generated writing. I've heard some of it read out loud on a few podcasts. There's podcasts out there that discuss this in depth and very well. I think the New York Times put out one that was really quite excellent not so long ago. But I don't know, my feelings are mixed. I mean, I think as a tool, AI has its uses. Meat for Tea has a firm ironclad stance that we will not accept AI-generated art or writing. Obviously, if someone fools us, then yeah. Eggs on our face. And mm-hmm. I guess if they fool us, more power to them. And no, I'm not issuing a challenge, listeners.
So. No, we don't do that.
No. But am I afraid of a possible, what would we call it, Philip K. Dickensian?
Right. Yes, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Am I afraid of a Philip K. Dickensian future where the AI is in, you can't distinguish it, indistinguishable from human-generated writing when right. it can educate itself and keep on educating itself. So it just needs to be like a few levels smarter, right?
You mean a few levels smarter than where it is now, or a few levels?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And they're working on it all the time to make
all the time. Better. And there's some really great minds.
Really great minds, and
behind that project.
It makes me think about what the value of being able to string together a good sentence, you know, like we try to do every morning, we're going to put a sentence down on the page.
Right.
But if I can just have my AI do it every morning, what's the value in my doing it? Right. That's the existential question.
It is.
I think right now the value in it is like, I'll compare it to running or the exercise that you do in the morning. Right. I don't have to run. I could drive for a couple of miles in the morning. I would cover the same distance, right?
And you might look different after yeah, 5 years of that yes. practice.
But and that's it, right? So I guess what I'm getting at is what does I'm inventing a new term, literary fitness, right? What does literary fitness?
Ooh, you've got to write the book, textbook.
So I got to put that down. What does literary fitness look like in in 5 years, if all you're doing instead of writing yourself is you're having the AI write a sentence for you every day. And I think we know that if we did that, we would be the characters in WALL-E who are just, so fat we have to be carried around on.
Right, right, right. Gross. What a great movie.
Yeah.
I love that film.
And then to get back to your point about, the teaching part. I think what I hope to get out of it is, like, if I have a class of students and I'm confronting this challenge, which I am, one of the things that I've seen happen, which I'm trying to make to happen, is to get to this exercising the muscle thing that we've been talking about, where uh-huh. I don't just ask for, okay, give me 500 words by such and such a time. It's more like, we're going to have a discussion. Now you're going to take out a piece of paper and you're going to write down your thoughts on this. And then I'm going to take a look at those thoughts. Now, I'm not going to grade them or anything, but I just want to know what you're thinking. And I'll give them back to you. And then you're going to take that and you're going to go further down the line. So that way I know what your writing is like. I know where your thinking is going.
Yeah, yeah.
Because as you know, what students
Good
don't
stuff.
Students don't understand that your teacher does know how you write.
They will know your writing voice.
Yeah, they will know it. So I think it gives, I guess I'm wondering about the opportunities that exist in the current AI environment, the opportunities that exist to leverage what AI is doing to actually create better writers out there, because they will have to spend more time on the pre-writing stuff and the stuff that happens before you hit print, because that's the important stuff when it comes to getting your ideas out.
Totally.
So look at that. We solved it. We figured it out.
We did. This is so very near and dear to my heart. I could go on and on, but I won't because it's getting later. But my PhD studies were in composition rhetoric.
Oh, okay.
Writing and the teaching of writing. And Peter Elbow was my dissertation chair, or would yeah. have been had I written one. So I was under the seminal at that time. I was very excited to be admitted into the writing program at UMass when I was, because it was at that time the top rated program in my field in the country.
Wow.
And it was Peter Elbow and Ann Harrington and Charlie Moran, like such seminal. I know as a woman, I should be wary that I'm going to piss off a lot of my fellow feminists with that word, and I should probably find a new one.
Yeah, we're just adding to the list of people we're upsetting. It's okay.
But that's what we're going to call this. The title will be the list is growing longer. But seminal figures in the field, really, their writing was truly groundbreaking. And, you know, Peter Elbow's the process guru.
Yep.
So, yeah, I like to think that my students wouldn't even have been tempted to try AI because my main goal as their professor, and, you know, obviously I was given a lot of 101 and 102, which I didn't mind because comp was my bag. Anyway, my main goal is to get them to care so passionately about their ideas and their voice that the idea of having anything else do it for them was horrifying.
Right.
That's the thing, is if there's passion behind the thing, and I think it is, that some emotional drive, it doesn't have to be strictly passion, but something coming off the page that makes a reader respond to it, if that's happening, then why would you want to get a machine to step right in for you?
Yeah, AI is not creating that kind of prose right now.
And not anybody, at all.
Yeah, not at all. And anybody, like, and also, I'm glad you have that policy that says, you're not gonna publish any AI generated work.
And oh yeah, it's ironclad. Now, like, if they fool us,
but why? Like, what would the goal of that be? The goal is so antithetical to what Meat for Tea is about. Right?
It is.
Meat for Tea is not about celebrating, oh, look, I can generate something in this AI and get it past these people, right?
You're not going to get a paycheck from us.
No. And Meat for Tea, to me, Meat for Tea is about the experience that I had at that Russian caravan Cirque, where I had this story, it came to me in a new way. I hadn't written fiction in a while. I put it on the page. I worked on it. I sent it in. It got accepted. It got published. And then I had the opportunity to share it live. Like that was an awesome experience. And
I'm so glad.
No AI can give me that same thrill, and no AI can appreciate that experience either.
I agree. And imagine if that story had been generated by AI and I was fooled and I published it and you came to the Cirque and you read it. I have to imagine that the experience would have paled by comparison.
Oh, I would have been, well, first of all, it wouldn't have been me. It would have been something completely different because I wouldn't do that, right?
It would be dastardly, wouldn't it? That would be a dastardly deed.
Well, I mean, yeah, I don't know what the right word is. Like, dastardly is close, but it's more
I like it.
it's a strong one, but it's also like, I don't know, it's strong, but it's not strong enough because it's somebody who is flipping the metaphorical middle finger at everything you stand for. And like, why would that person want to, why would you want to do that? Like, what's, sure you could, but what do you gain from that?
Nothing.
Nothing. Nothing at all. Just
nothing at all.
No, but I gain so much from doing what I did. Right. So that's the difference.
Yeah. So I guess, like, if I were still teaching now, yeah, I'd probably do a lot of things the same way I did. I stopped teaching in 2009 abruptly, but the same way I did then, because we did a lot of writing in class.
Yep.
A lot of free writing.
I do free writing every day in my class.
Yeah, we did too. Actually, it was the first 5 minutes of every class, which is one way to try to make sure people don't get there late.
Yep.
Is the prompt, and to make it more enticing to show up in time. Prompts are student generated. So you don't want to be rude and miss your friend's prompt.
And free writing also, I use it all the time for myself.
You know, me too.
It's a wonderful.
Me too. I use
exercise, whatever it is. Yeah, it's great.
I use so many of Peter Elbow's tools. That one and the loop writing method.
Yep. Yep.
He's a I mean, I guess he's not a brand name to everyone, but if you know, you know.
I know him.
And he is a brand name to me, and he is for a reason. And he's a charming fellow, too.
So the next time we talk in the podcast, we'll have to talk about not writing, but the teaching of writing. That'll be the next thing that we can
talk about. I could talk for 1,000 years about pedagogy.
Well, how long can you talk about the pedagogy of grammar instruction? Because that's something that I've been thinking a lot about.
I could talk for a while about it, actually.
We'll book that for our next conversation.
Okay.
I've been researching the history of grammar instruction in the United States, and it's fascinating because...
Oh, how interesting.
Well, I mean, the history of it is like the group of, you know, now they're dead white men, right? The group of middle-aged white guys who got together and started studying Latin and Greek grammar and then said, okay, well, we need to study English grammar the same way, and we need to know the rules, and we need to...
Strunk.
Yeah. So it all becomes the rules, and then it's like, okay, well, who's going to teach this in college? And well, first of all, do we need this in college? And then, because all the college English people would just be like, well, we just want to talk about the great books. We don't want to do anything else. Then it was like, no, you got to do this too. So it's a question of like, okay, well, there's grammar, but then where does usage fit in, and where does syntax fit in, and
right rules. Parsing a sentence.
Yeah, are they rules? Yeah. And really what started me going down the path of that research is the basic question of, and I had this argument with an administrator a number of years ago, teaching grammar does not improve student writing.
I agree. Peter Albo agrees.
Yeah, and there's many studies out there that say the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. Cool. I hard agree.
And it's part of the Common Core. It's on the SAT. It's on the MCAS. It's something that kind of lingers out there. And it just had me...
Do not get me started on the MCAS.
So it just got me thinking about, you know, what is the role of grammar in writing instruction, and what should the role of grammar be? And one of the fascinating things is like, if you think about, I think about sentence fragments, and some people will say, well, sentence fragments are always bad. And I think to myself,
no, they're not.
Well, but I'm sure you use them at some point. Like, they're not always
they're
bad.
Not bad.
They're not bad.
I think it's, you should know the rule before you break it, though.
Well, that's the other part of it, right? In order to teach somebody about sentence fragments, there are like 7 things that they have to know. So then you're spending your time talking about grammar, right? In the big evil big G sense, and you're spending less time talking about writing. And the studies also show, and Peter Albo has probably written them and would agree with them, the students will pay attention to the grammar when they're working on something that is interesting to them.
Exactly. Oh my God.
So that's yes. Where we need to be. And we can't just have these dry grammar lessons. Instead, it gets back to all the stuff we're talking about, the process of it, and getting people invested and excited about their work, right? And AI is not going to do that.
There's a book. You need to check it out if you haven't. It's amazing. I read it when I was actually working on the master's. And this book is called Writing with Passion, okay. Life Stories, Multiple Genres.
Who wrote that one?
Tom Romano.
Yeah.
Another mafia guy. It is amazing. It totally revitalized it. Well, my teaching was already vitalized because I was young in my career then, but it's amazing.
Yeah. I wrote that one down.
You need it. Oh my God, you got me going on pedagogy. I could talk for 100 years about
We were nerding out big time on that.
I could nerd out. I mean, that's my bag.
Oh.
I have a dissertation in my head that I was working on. I had a part of it on paper that I was working on, but yeah. I didn't get through it. So anyway, you will be reading Tom Romano's Writing with Passion.
I wrote that one down. Yes.
I'm telling you, it's because, first of all, if a student is writing with true passion, a weird thing happens even with an unskilled writer, and the language flows together more tidily.
Yes.
Of its own accord. And it's magical how that happens.
And that's the same type of magic that can happen when people try personal narrative storytelling. Most people will say, oh, I don't have a story to tell. Nothing interesting has ever happened to me. Of course, that's not true. Everybody has a story to tell.
Every single person.
Yeah, it's about figuring that out. And because from the starting point, it's personal. It's about you. That interest is already there, right? I'm already interested in this because it's me, it's mine, and I'm telling it to you. So yes, you're absolutely right. That magic is vital to a great story,
mm-hmm. and to great writing, and even yes. to grammatically correct writing, or writing that is so good and so powerfully voiced that the reader does not give a shit about the grammar. That can right. happen too.
Yes. I mean, ideally, what will happen is that the writer becomes so invested, and if their grammar skills aren't the best, there will comes a point where they're going to recognize that they're going to be like, hey, this sentence doesn't seem to work, or this part doesn't seem to work.
How do I fix that?
Yeah. How do I fix that? Why is that happening? And that's where that learning takes place. Yeah. All we got to do is make that happen for everybody in every writing situation, and everything will be great.
Oh my God. Yeah. Actually, my very starry-eyed master's thesis is all about harnessing epiphany moments. Oh, the naivete. It was so cute. Just because I witnessed it happen in a few of my students, and their minds would light fire, and all of a sudden their writing would become brilliant. I'm like, all we need to do is just harness that. Like, it's a
all
thing
we gotta
you can
do.
Generate.
That's all we got to do. Yeah.
All we got to do, just that little thing.
All we got to do is remember all of our dreams, and everything's going to be fine.
Epiphany moments. Oh, my thesis chair liked it. Thank goodness for that. I got the
degree.
That's
all I meant.
Anyway, what are you reading right now?
I am reading Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver.
Ooh, I want to read that. That is on my TBR list.
It was a gift. I was gifted it a couple of months ago, and I finally got around to reading it. And
nice.
Right from the very beginning, her prose is so great. It just draws you in. And I'm also fascinated by the idea that she's updating a classic novel. So I always like that idea of how authors take other authors' work and kind of, you know, put their own spin on it.
It's because it's David Copperfield, right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I listened to a podcast about this. I love Kingsolver.
This is the first of her novels I've read. So I have a lot of, that's good because I can go back and read the other ones now.
Ooh, be excited.
Oh, I am. Yeah.
Poisonwood Bible.
Yeah. And the, what was the first one that was?
The Bean Eaters.
Yeah, that's the one. I've heard I got to read that one.
I've read a lot of her. There's another one she wrote, which has Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera appearing as characters in it. The name is escaping me. I'll message you. I'll let you know. Okay. But I recommend that one too. I think you probably can't go wrong with Kingsolver.
And that's how I'm feeling so far.
I'm jealous. I can't wait to read that. That is on my list. Awesome. Wow. So what are you listening to? What is on your turntable if you listen to music on such an antiquated device?
More than anything else recently, I, I'm it's going to sound trite and cliched and all those other words, but I've been listening to a lot of Bruce Springsteen.
I don't judge. He's got some awesome music.
But here's why I'm doing it. Yes, number one, I have to because I grew up in New Jersey. Sure, that's true. But
oh, I'm de rigueur.
Yeah, I'm going to go see him in Albany in April, and I'm going to be bringing my son, my younger son, is going to go with me. So I'm brushing up on my Springsteen so that I can do the proper thing and, you know, educate my son on how to properly understand and appreciate it.
That's wonderful.
And it's also, this is a show that was originally supposed to happen in March of 2023. And then Springsteen got COVID.
Mm-hmm.
So it was postponed until September of 2023. And then Springsteen got ulcers. And now it's scheduled for April. And, you know, just like all of us, he's not getting any younger. So I'm like, okay, I better take this opportunity now and go see him.
Oh, how wonderful. Oh, that's just so great to take your kid to that too.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be a fun time.
Yeah. No, that's wow.
And in April, it's going to be spring. It's going to be warm, right? It's going to be great.
Maybe. April is the month that, isn't that the old adage?
The cruelest month?
Oh, because it's March that can either come in like a lamb or go out like a lion.
Yeah, that's right. March.
Yeah. But April's the cruelest. That's a T.S. Eliot thing. Right, yes. Right. So, yeah.
T.S. Eliot that I referenced in the Raisin story.
Yes, you did. T.S. Eliot, amateurs borrow, experts steal. I had that on my office door. And T.S. Eliot also, whose name, well, just with the initials, can be rearranged to spell toilets.
Oh, that's true. I hadn't realized that.
Fun fact.
I love that.
Disrespectful things you can do with author names. So, what are you watching right now?
Slow Horses on Apple TV.
I have heard tell.
It's fabulous. So, Gary Oldman is...
I love him.
He's a fantastic actor. He's one of, like, only a handful...
Oh, my God.
...who... At times I've been like genuinely frightened by his performances because he kind of gets so into the characters, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The character he's playing in Slow Horses is not frightening, but it is classic Oldman, and he's giving it his all as an aging spy master, overseeing a group of spies who have done something wrong in the service and are working in this part of the service that is far removed from the headquarters, and they don't get to do anything interesting or fun. But it's really an interesting and fun series. So I'm really enjoying that. Slow Horses on Apple TV.
Oh my gosh. Now I'm going to have to add Apple TV to our streaming platforms.
You won't regret it.
I just have to figure out which one to kill to make the budget space to add it.
Yeah, that's always the challenge.
Do you do that?
It's a full-time job keeping up with that, right? Like, I finished this series on this streaming service, so I'll cancel that one for this month. Then I can add this other one, you know, and then it's like, you have to, every month you got to like review which ones you're using.
I mean, unless you're rich, I guess, then you can just have them all. I think pretty soon they're going to turn this whole streaming platform business into just cable 2.0.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's kind of going that way. We've got Hulu and HBO Max and Netflix and Peacock. So one of those will have to die.
And do you have Amazon Prime? Because everybody...
Oh, yeah, we've got Prime. We've got Prime.
So they're also the ones like Amazon Prime that you forget that you have. Like, oh, yeah, I have that one. Oh, yeah, I have this one. Yeah, I know it.
Yeah.
I don't have HBO Max. I know that. But that's the one that I think about. I think about adding the most frequently. But
we're watching Succession.
Yeah, see, there's so
finally.
Many I've never seen it, so I'll have to consider that too.
It's brilliant.
There's so many brilliant shows on right now. It's wonderful.
The line by line writing, and now I'm actually quoting someone from NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, Glenn Weldon, who's like, can we talk about the line by line writing in Succession? And just, it's so precise and sharp edged and hilarious in the darkest way possible. Like, for a writer, it's just, you just admire each sentence.
Well, do you get a, will you get a royalty when I sign up now for HBO? Like, you get a little cut of the, you get a commission?
I should. I should. Are you listening, HBO execs? Well, this has been such a treat. And I think we should do a part two. Maybe we'll do it on the Patreon side.
We'll do, I mean, there's, we just can't, like, the whole education. Yeah, I think that would be awesome. I'm available anytime you want me. This has been great, Elizabeth. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk.
With you. So much fun, and thanks for being so generous with your time. We went on a piece, didn't we?
We did. But that's perfectly great because we just had fun. So that's awesome.
Well, if it's not icy and disgusting out on the 25th, I'll probably see you at Luthier's.
All right, that'll be great. We start at 7 o'clock, and it's always a fun show.
Maybe I'll bring a story.
Oh, that'd be awesome. That'd be cool.
I might do that.
All right. Well, that sounds great.
All right.
Well, thanks again. You have a good night.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Wasn't that wonderful?
That was terrific.
So much fun.
I actually learned a lot from that one. It was
if
really
you
cool.
want to meet Andrew in person and you live in the 413, come on over to Luthier's Co-op on Card Street in East Hampton, Thursday the 25th, 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
You can see him work his magic.
Really great storytelling evening that he does every month. So that's wonderful. Thank you so much for sticking around for the Meeper TCast. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another one of our installments of our
Pushcart nominees.
Yes, exactly. Our Pushcart nominees. Thank you so much. See you again in a couple weeks.
The Meet for Tea cast is produced by Elizabeth McDuffie and Meet for Tea, The Valley Review. Visit Meet for Tea at www.meetfortea.com. Please consider going to anchor.fm to make a contribution through our contribution page. You can reach us through meetforteacast@gmail.com, or you can leave a voice message at anchor.fm/meetforteacast. We welcome suggestions for contents for the Meet for Tea cast. If you've attended a Meet for Tea circ and want to hear from one of the bands or one of the spoken word contributors, please let us know. All portions are copyright Meet for Tea and their respective holders. Vote for Meet for Tea on your favorite podcast app. Follow us on Twitter at Elizabeth. Meet for Tea on Instagram. And on the Meet for Tea and Meet for Tea cast Facebook pages. Meet for Tea is available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts.